we'll get going. So in the grand scheme of things, in this effective Lagrangian, we've been talking about L5 and L6. Let's go back and look at L0 and L2, because one of the things we were doing was comparing the size you actually have in the standard model to the generic size you would expect. And the more or less the rule is, if you're seeing something small compared to, at least in L4 and all the other examples we know, when you see something smaller than you generically expect it to be, then that's normally the sign that there's some selection rule or approximate symmetry going on. Because if it is, if the thing you're looking at is something which would have been zero if the setting of it to zero would have given you more symmetry, then that symmetry can forbid corrections from generating that term. Because if for example, if you have a rotationally invariant problem, and then someone gives you a very small rotation breaking interaction, any corrections to the rotation breaking interaction have to be themselves proportional to the rotation breaking interaction, because in the absence of the if the, in the limit that the rotation breaking goes to zero, the corrections all preserve rotation invariant. So the so if you have a so there's a this this you could call a Tuft naturalness, that if the thing you're looking at that's smaller than normal has the property that when you set it to zero, you get more symmetries than you had before, then that's something which is a natural thing to have found to be small. And it's telling you the information you're getting by finding a small parameter is that there were approximate symmetries in the problem. And that's some information about the higher energies that you wouldn't have otherwise have had. But so if you kind of apply that logic to the first two terms, the cosmological constant and the Higgs mass, which are the only ones with dimensions, they're small. This one is less than an electron volt to the fourth power, and this one is hundreds of GeV squared. But if we've integrated out the grand unified scale, then the generic thing we would have expected here would be something involving the positive powers of the grand unified scale. And so in that sense, this is smaller than it generically should have been. And so then the question is that telling us that there's some approximate symmetry going on that we wanted to know about? And the short answer is, so people spend a lot of time thinking, are there symmetries that can make those things go away? And the answer is, there are symmetries that can make them go away, but only in the limit that the symmetries are completely unbroken. If the symmetry you're talking about is an approximate symmetry, not an exact symmetry, they don't go away. But the amount by which they don't go away is typically the weak scale. So it remains a puzzle as to how to understand the cosmological constant. But it could be an understanding of why this scale is at the weak scale. In general, the statement is that there are symmetries that people know, a big one of which is supersymmetry, which is the topic here that I'm trying to set up, that can enforce that these things would be at most the weak scale to the fourth or weak scale squared or less. And so it could tell you why it's not the Planck scale that's appearing here. But once you get into lower energies, you're into a regime where we actually know a lot about what's going on. And so it's harder to kind of pull symmetries out of your ears. So the spirit of this stuff is so if you kind of think about this term, let's focus on this term because it's the one that sets up supersymmetry, although supersymmetry does make progress in this one too, in the sense of making the natural scale the weak scale rather than the higher. If you ask kind of what kind of symmetries could get rid of this term, an answer that won't work is an internal symmetry. If you imagine multiplying phi by some matrix, a unitary matrix, or if you think of the four real components, it could be an orthogonal matrix. The reason that doesn't help is that in order to be a symmetry, it's got to be, before you talk about this term, you talk about the kinetic term, because that's got to be there. And anything along those lines that's a linear transformation that makes the kinetic term invariant, if this matrix is constant, will automatically make this term also invariant. So for scalars, one of the puzzles was you can't find internal symmetries that are making that could help you suppress that. That's a generic problem for scalars. The same is not true for fermions. So for fermions, if I had had a Lagrangian psi bar d slash psi, and I added a mass term psi bar psi, the symmetries of this kinetic term are psi can go to e to the I phase times psi, but I can also go to e to the I beta times gamma 5 times psi. So I can rotate the left and right-handed parts of the field the same way or oppositely, and those are equally good symmetries for this term. But this term only respects this symmetry and not this one. And so because of that, when you actually integrate out, say, in a grand unified theory, heavy particles, there's no mystery as to why the fermions in the problem could be light because they're all protected by symmetries like this. That they typically, what you typically find for fermions is that the correction to a fermion mass due to loops is proportional to that same fermion mass times some coupling constants, you know, maybe alpha over 2 pi or something, times a logarithm, because now it has to be dimensionless. And logarithms are not a big deal. It's the powers, it's powers of big scales that are a problem. And so the reason you get this, the mass is proportional to itself is that the presence of the mass was required to break this axial symmetry. And so if the mass had been zero, the correction is also zero because this axial symmetry kills the correction. So I told you that story because one of the ideas, so there are several space-time symmetries you can use to try and forbid these two terms. The obvious one is scale invariance. These are the only things that have a dimensions in the problem. So scale invariance is something you can play with. And probably for the cosmological constant problem, that's where my money is going to be. Although there's no known solution that built on that. But the supersymmetry way of thinking about it is to say, why don't we use the fact that the fermions are actually protected to protect the scalars? Because if we had a symmetry that related scalars to fermions, and the fact that and the fermions are protected by internal symmetries, then as long as the symmetry that connects the fermions to the scalars is unbroken, then the scalars will be just as protected as the fermions because they'll have to have the same mass. That's the logic of supersymmetry. So you're looking. So it's I include it as a space-time symmetry for reasons you're going to see in a second. But one way to think about that is that internal symmetries are ones for which the Lagrangian is invariant, whereas space-time symmetries are ones for which the action is invariant, but the Lagrangian goes to a total derivative. So it's going to turn out that supersymmetry has that property. So how would you make a symmetry that relates particles of different spin? So if you think about what that means, under an ordinary symmetry, you know, if you vary a field, if you say that one field is a symmetry parameter times a generator, usually the factor of I, times a field, they both share the same spin because this what's the space-time dependence here, if that was a local function, say, or if that's not a local function, whatever this was, it was a scalar. And so that way, that if this was a scalar, this equation made sense, because, and this would be a scalar because that was a scalar. And the same thing's true if we have a fermion and we say that it's transforming in some similar manner. That's a spinner, and it's consistent because that's a scalar. So the thing to try if you want to relate scalars to fermions is to say, well, we want the variation of the scalar to involve a fermion. And so what we need is something that takes a spinner to a scalar. So let's imagine that the parameter of the symmetry is a spinner. And I'm going to put in I'll kind of get back to it in a second, is I'm going to take the left-handed part of that fermion. So I'm going to imagine this as a complex scalar. And this would be a guess for a transformation rule where we have a scalar here. We have a spin a half fermion here. And that means this thing would have to be a spin, a spinner, a fermionic spinner. So it'll be like a Grassmann field rather than a regular field. And then that would be consistent. And since we'd have a scalar, all those Rentz transformation properties would be consistent. And if you ask what the dimensions of these fields are, you know, this scalar field has dimensions of mass, and a spin a half field has dimensions of mass to the 3/2. So that means that this has to have this parameter, whatever it is, has to have dimensions mass to the minus 1/2 in order for that to be consistent. And that's relevant because if these things are transforming into each other, there should be some rule for the fermion. Let me take the left-handed part here. It's going to involve epsilon somehow. It's got to involve the scalar somehow. And if we look at the dimensions, this has got dimensions of mass to the 3/2. This has got dimensions of mass. This is mass to the minus 1/2. So this altogether is a square root of mass. And so we're missing a power of mass to make something consistent here. So we need something else to get the dimensions to work. So the thing to put in there is a derivative. So let's put in a derivative, and that makes the dimensions work. But then we need a gamma matrix to make the indices work. And then if this is left-handed, then this would have to be right-handed. Or if we had a mass to the particle, you know, if we had an explicit mass, we could do something like this. That would also work if we have masses. And you can kind of do the same kind of exercise for a gauge field. So if you
fraction of a K field, you can imagine it being epsilon bar. We can get this index by putting a gamma matrix in, and this could be our fermion field. This would relate a spin one, a spin half, and then we could relate delta lambda. If they, you know, these things could carry a gauge index. We could have something like epsilon. I'm gonna write something which I know is gonna turn out to be the right answer. The field strength and gamma mu nu. That would be that has the right dimensions too. So this was a mass. This had to be this is a mass to the 3/2. So this is again a mass to the minus 1/2. And this all works because we've got a derivative hidden inside F. So we were looking for the same reason we had a derivative here. We're looking for something involving derivative of A, but we had to have a gauge invariant thing, and that's kind of where F came from. And that should not be an A, that should be a nu. So you can kind of guess transformations like this. And they have this nice property that imagine that you did two of them in a row. You start off with a scalar, and you vary it, and you vary it again. The first variation would give you this. So we'd have epsilon 1 bar gamma left, the variation of psi. And then the second variation would give you this. That would be epsilon 1 bar gamma left gamma mu epsilon 2 times d mu phi. And let me just imagine we don't have a mass for now. If we did this in the opposite order and we wanted to see what the algebra of the symmetry, what symmetry group were we talking about? Actually, that's it. So I don't know if you ever worried about this, but if someone gives you a symmetry, the reason you're interested in whether it's a group or not is that if I tell you this is the Lagrangians invariant under some transformations, delta of one of some Lagrangian zero, and if I keep on doing more and more variations, if they're always if each one is a new variation, then I'm going to get so many conditions that the only Lagrangian that'll be invariant will be the zero Lagrangian. In order for there to be a useful Lagrangian which is constrained by a symmetry, it has to be true that if I keep applying the symmetry, eventually I get the same things back again and I'm not getting new conditions. And that's why people, when you propose something like a symmetry transformation like this out of whole cloth, what you want to check is that if you kind of do this, if I take the commutator, delta 2, delta 1, minus delta 1, delta 2, I want this to be something I recognize as being already a symmetry. Otherwise, I'm going to have to take that, whatever I find, and take the commutator of it with things I already have to find out what's the class of things I'm asking the Lagrangian to be invariant under. So if I just take 1 to 2 here and take and use the fact that this is gamma left in the conventions I'm using is 1/2 1 plus gamma 5, the gamma 5, gamma left piece is symmetric under the interchange of 1 and 2. And the one term is anti-symmetric. So what'll happen is that the gamma 5 will cancel and the one will survive in this difference. And then the two terms will get rid of the half. So we're going to get something like epsilon 1 bar gamma 2, gamma mu epsilon 2, and d mu phi. And that you recognize as a symmetry we've already imposed. This is a translation. Because if we ask how does a scalar field vary under translations, we would have said, well, delta 5x. We shift phi. So that's to say if we translate by some distance epsilon, then the infinitesimal transformation is that. And so all we've done is we found that two supersymmetries commute to give us a translation. And so in that sense, supersymmetry is a space-time symmetry because two of them gives you what you honest to God thought was a space-time symmetry, a translation. So SUSY is like the square root of a translation. That'll be a problem. Is this fixable, do you know, or is it?
Not easily.
If I just try and force it, do you think that'll be a problem?
I wouldn't recommend it.
There you go. So far, so good. All right, so that tells you several things. One thing it tells you is that if you ever wanted to take the symmetry and gauge it, so make things local so that the epsilons are functions of position, then you're going to, for sure,
automatically be also be doing local translations, which is to say you'll be doing something generally covariant. So local supersymmetry will always involve gravity because it's going to be generally covariant. That's one observation. Another observation is if we ask in terms of generators what's going on there, if I write the change of the field as being the commutator of the parameter times some charge commuting with the field, then that statement about the taking symmetries in opposite order gives me a translation that says that if I take the anti-commutator of this charge, Q with Q bar, I'm getting, this is a fermion, and this is a boson, so this has to also be fermionic. These are scalars, and that's spin a half, so that has to also be spin a half. So that's what bar is kind of, think of this as each one of these is a Dirac spinner's worth of operators, and bar is the Dirac conjugate. And this will be, turns out to be 2i times gamma mu times p mu. So that means that you repeat the commutator of epsilon bar times q will be the anti-commutator of two q's, and that'll be translation. And so the algebra you're headed to is, this is called a graded algebra because it's got anti-commutators as well as commutators. So once you make the observation that that kind of a transformation is possible, and you can write down some Lagrangians that have this kind of a symmetry. I'm not making these symmetries up from nothing. And it's not just that you can write down free theories that have the symmetry, because free theories have lots of symmetries. You can write interacting theories that have these kind of symmetries. Then you kind of start saying, well, so what are the options? How many symmetries can I imagine having of this type? And what's the general rule for making up space-time symmetries? And so there's an answer to that. So the general formulation starts from an earlier formulation. If we hadn't been talking about graded algebras and we'd just been talking about Lie algebras, back in the 60s, the Coleman-Mangula theorem says that for Lie algebras, the most general symmetry generators that can commute with an S matrix which is not equal to 1. A lot of things commute with the trivial S matrix, but for some interacting S matrix, the most general ordinary symmetries of the S matrix have the form of Lorentz generators, momentum generators. So altogether, this is the Poincaré algebra of special relativity, plus internal symmetries. So these are the things that we normally talk about as symmetries, where the parameter is a scalar, so it's just an ordinary charge, like electric charge. And that's it. And the observation they made was that if you tried to, and the reason they were doing this was back in the 60s, people were talking about the non-relativistic quark model, and they recognized that there was an SU3 flavor that changed the up, down, and strange quarks into one another. But it's also true that they all had spin a half, and so that there was an SU2 that related the spins. So someone proposed, what about SU6, which would include SU3 and SU2, kind of like SU5 containing the standard model. And they asked, what's the representations of that? Does that describe what you see amongst the hadrons? And it did pretty well. So people started thinking, oh, maybe we should be thinking of bigger groups that contain space-time symmetries and internal symmetries, but are more general. And so that's what led them to start asking this question. And they found that actually you can't really do it relativistically. If you have the Poincaré invariants, you can have things that commute with Poincaré invariants, but you don't get other things that are not Poincaré transformations that don't commute with Poincaré transformations. So you don't get things, other charges with indices on them that are vectors or tensors. And the reason more or less is that if you did, and you tried to scatter, then, you know, if you did two body scattering, you know that energy and momentum conservation basically leave the only undetermined thing as a scattering angle. And if you had other conserved things that carried indices, that would overdetermine the momentum, the momenta in the scattering,
and you would be told what the scattering angle is. Typically, it would be zero, and so you'd be led to a trivial S matrix. And so it's hard to, you can't write down conserved things that are not, that are, that depend on space-time, and so it will involve the momenta of the states involved in an interacting theory. So the reason that you, that that's useful for us is that people had known this for a long time, but once people realized they could do supersymmetry, they said, well, what we can do, if we are now talking about graded algebras, is we can take the thing on the right-hand side here is the stuff that would go into this theorem, and we know that whatever it is, it should satisfy this Coleman-Mangula theorem. So all we're allowed to have here is stuff which is of that form of internal symmetries and the Poincaré group. And then what you can use is the Jacobi identity, you know, which just says that A with B with C plus cyclic is always zero. To, if I apply the Jacobi identity to, so let's say I take J mu nu and take the commutator with this and I use the Jacobi identity, then I can take the fact that this side, the right-hand side here, was only these things and start learning about what the most general things I'm allowed to write here. I could say, well, let's just call this X and let's take the commutator of Q with itself. Let's call that y, and I'll use the Jacobi identity to learn the properties of x and y by then comparing the bosonic part to this and using the fact that the bosonic part has to always look like that. And that'll allow me to decide what's the most general commutation rules these q's can satisfy, which are the new things. And so that exercise was done by Hag, Opozanski, and Sonius. So it's called the Hag-Wobozansky-Sonius theorem. And basically what it says is that the only thing that can J mu nu with the Qs, you can have more than one Q, so let me call it Qi. So that's not the spinner index. That's kind of, I could have N of these spinners. But this basically, I'm going to have numerical factors I'm going to get wrong here. But basically J has to commute with the Lorentz generator commutes with Q to give you gamma matrices times Q. Gamma mu nu, should have said, is 1/2 the commutator of gamma mu, gamma nu. And that's basically, there's probably an I in there. That's basically the transformation law for a spinner. So that just says that the Qs are all spinners. Although you could have more than one of them. So typically N is used to describe how many there are. And then if you kind of apply it to Q with itself and not its complex conjugate, what you find is that Qi with Qj anticommutes to zero. And that Qi Qj conjugate is what we had already. So it's 2i gamma mu p mu times delta ij. So that means that for each of the Qs, anticommutes with its own conjugate in the way that we found, but they don't anticommute with the other guy's conjugate in any interesting way. And then you're also allowed to write down something involving internal symmetries, what's called central charges. And it does not involve a gamma matrix gamma mu. So it involves, let me write it as A plus B gamma 5 times epsilon ij. So this thing, if I slapped an epsilon, two symmetry parameters, you know, epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 on both sides, it turns out to be anti-symmetric under the interchange of them. So this gamma matrix, so that means if I swap the spin indices and the ij indices, it has to be anti-symmetric. And this already is anti-symmetric, so that's why this was symmetric, and it turned out to be 1. This is symmetric in the spin indices, so this has to be anti-symmetric in ij. So if you only had, if n were 1, you can't have this. And that's the case we're going to talk about mostly, n equals 1 supersymmetry. But if you have two or more symmetries, then you can have things here. But these things, whatever they are, they have to be linear combinations of these internal symmetries, and they have to commute with everything. So those are something that commutes with everything is called a central charge. And sometimes you find when you're doing more than one supersymmetry that they appear, so that they not only can be there, but they are there.
Excuse me? How can you say the gamma mu p mu term is anti-symmetric?
It's because the it's specifically the gamma mu term. So it's that what a statement I'm making is that if you had two Majorana spinners, so it's important that they're Majorana spinners, The statement is that epsilon bar 1 epsilon 2 is equal to minus epsilon 2 bar epsilon 1 for Majorana spinners. And if, you know, similarly, epsilon 1 bar gamma mu gamma 5 epsilon 2 is equal to plus epsilon 2 bar gamma mu gamma 5 epsilon 1. And if I and if I had here 1 or gamma 5, it would also be plus. And if for gamma mu nu, it's a minus again. And the reason you can do this is that because they're Majorana, it means that epsilon bar is epsilon transpose times some matrix. And so because that's the reality condition. The reality condition says that the complex conjugate of the spinner is the matrix times the spinner again. So what you're saying is that if you have a left-handed part and a right-handed part, you're saying that the right-handed part is basically the left-handed part complex conjugate times some matrix or something. That's the Majorana condition. And so that statement is this statement. And so if I now take this thing and I use the fact that the epsilons anticommute with each other because they're spinners, they're fermions, then I can just take this thing and I can write them in the opposite order and transpose the matrix. And I find what I get, and that the signs I'm telling are what you get when you do that. But if what you're used to probably is if these had not been Majorana, so you can't use this, then if this has been these have been Dirac spinners, for example, then it wouldn't be true that they're anticommute. And the important thing that I've kind of glossed over is that these are Majorana. If they had not been Majorana, that would really be like two spinners. That's like having a complex field. I could break it into a Majorana and an anti-Majorana piece, like I could take a complex field to make it real and measure it. So when you're counting them, you count the Majorana ones because those are the independent ones. Okay, so if n is not 1, that's called extended supersymmetry. And typically n is less than or equal to 8. And 0, I guess, counts as not supersymmetry. And so let me tell you why that's in four dimensions. So to say why that's true, we need to talk about the transformation rules for or representations for particles. So we want the middle one now. So particle representations. And I'm going to do massless particles, partly because it's simple and partly because, you know, in field theories, in practice, you make the massive particles from the massless ones by doing spontaneous symmetry breaking. So if you know the massless ones, you can figure out what the massive ones are doing. So what you know is that if I take Q and I act on, so Qi, let's say, and I act on some state with some Hilbert. So because they're massless, I don't talk about spin, I talk about helicity. I'll get some new state, H tilde. And because J commutes with Q to give me a spinner, that says that it's a spinner, so it has spin a half. And so that implies that, so the J Q equals Q commutator implies that H tilde has to be H plus a half. So if you give me a helicity something particle and I act on it with Q, I have a helicity something plus a half particle because of that commutation relation with the J's. That's kind of why the algebra is useful to know. And because Qi with Qj anti-commutes with itself, that means that if I repeatedly apply Q, I get 0. So if I take Q, say 1 squared on H, which would be Q1. Let's say Q1 is what gave me H tilde. That'll be 0. So if I take a state and I repeatedly act on it with the Qs, I don't get an infinite number of things. It stops because these things are anti-commuting with themselves. And so that means, in particular, the square of any one of them is 0. So that means, but if I have more than one of them, I can apply the first one, and I can apply the second one, and I can apply the third one until I've used them all up, and then I've applied everything I can. And then I can, so that means that if I start off with, say, helicity 0, so let's start off with, let's take n equals 1 first. That'll be the simplest case. So now we have only one supersymmetry. So that means I don't have more than one to worry about. So you give me a helicity, then helicity plus a half I will get by acting with a supersymmetry, and then I'm done.
So the massless particles will come in pairs of felicity that are stepped by a half. So the options are, if I don't want to talk about gravity, then the options, well, let's say I do want to talk about gravity. The options would be, I could start with a zero and get a half. I could start with a half and get one. I could start with one and I could get three halves. I could start with three halves and I could get two. And I could have the CPT conjugate of these things would all be opposite. So I could have a minus a half and zero. I could have minus one and minus a half, minus three halves and minus one, and minus two and minus three halves. And I don't go past two because we're doing massless particles and there's the Weinberg-Witten theorem. It basically says there's no massless interacting particles with h greater than 2. And more or less the reason for that is, again, the Coleman-Mangela theorem. If you had a particle with a helicity bigger than 2, there would have to have been a gauge invariance for it. And there would be a charge associated with that gauge invariance. And that charge would be not allowed to you because that would be something which would be inconsistent with the Coleman-Mangela theorem, which told you what you're allowed to have as charges. So the internal symmetries are the ones that, when you gauge them, give you the spin 1 particles. The Qs, the Ps and the Js, basically, when you gauge them, that gives you the spin 2 particle. That's the gravity, that's general covariance. And the spin 3 halves comes when you make a supersymmetry local. So that's the thing that'll give us a spin 3 halves gauge field. But beyond that, there's no more symmetries. And so that's kind of where this comes from. And so so that means that you don't normally talk about massless multiplets involving more than plus 2 or minus 2 in helicity. So, but you know, if you want to talk about fields, you know that fields, a field theory, a local field theory is always CPT invariant. So when you have fields to represent these things, you're going to always, you won't just get this thing by itself. You'll get this and its CPT conjugate because the field theory is always CPT invariant. So fields will represent CPT extended particle representations. So for example, if I want the lowest spins, if I have that one, CPT tells me I have to also have that one because CPT always flips the felicity. And so I could look for the field. It wouldn't make sense to look for the field content of this, but I can look for the field content of that and find a local field theory for it. And so what I'm looking for is basically two real scalar fields or one complex one. Scalar. And I have to have a helicity and its antiparticle, and so that's going to be the left-handed part of a field. So that'll be a left-handed part of a spinner. And it's convenient to think of them in terms of these Majorana spinners. So I'll take the left-handed part and I'll take the right-handed part of the Dirac spinner and I'll say it's the complex conjugate of the right-handed part, the left-handed part. Or Majorana. But if you like, you can also talk about the left-handed parts and always then add the complex conjugate later on. But it's easier to think about the reality of the Lagrangian in terms of the Majorana ones. And you get both the notations in the literature. But I think it's healthy to use the same notation for fermions here as you do everywhere else in life. So the Dirac fermions are probably the useful ones to think about. Dirac spinners that have a Majorana constraint. So that's what I'm going to do. And so that is true. You can take if you take a complex scalar field and a Majorana fermion, that combination does give you a field theory. That's the kind of what I chose as the first example up there. And that's called a chiral multiplet. And it's chiral because it involves just the left-handed fermion, not the right. And the right-handed one is a complex conjugate of the left-handed one. So it's not it doesn't have a particle. The electron would be two of those because you have the left-handed electron and the left-handed positron, or the left-handed electron and the right-handed electron as separate fields. Another example that comes up a lot is the 1/2 1, to which I have to add the CPT conjugate. That's called a gauge multiplet. And I can represent that and that with a gauge field. And that will be, again, a Majorana fermion. So that field content also you can make supersymmetric theories from, and those are the supersymmetric gauge theories.
And the gauge group normally, so if they'll each, so both A mu and lambda mu will be in the adjoint if the gauge group commutes with supersymmetry. And that would mean that it's in the internal symmetry part of this Coleman-Mandula argument that I gave you at the very top. In amongst those internal symmetries are your gauge symmetries, your ordinary gauge symmetries, and so it's in there. It's something which is commuting with the Poincaré group. There are symmetries that don't commute with Q. There's a, typically it's the things that shuffle, that rotate the Qs amongst themselves, so it's UN if you have N supersymmetries. But those are, when you gauge those, you're heading towards supergravity, because if you make a local transformation that rotates the Qs, then you have to have local Q transformations, which takes you to supergravity. So in global supersymmetry, typically the gauge symmetries commute with supersymmetry, and then everybody in a multiplet has the same representation. Okay, so the other one that comes up a lot is 3/2 2, so -2 -3/2, and that's described by the metric and the Gravitino field, the left-handed, the Majorana Gravitino field. So this is the gauge particle now for the general covariance, and this is the gauge particle for one of the supersymmetries. If you have n supersymmetries and you gauge them, you'll have n Gravitini in the way that I'm going to talk to you in a second. So this is the gravity multiplet. And these are called the Gravitini. The same way these are called the Gauginos. I don't know why they're not Gaugini. So if you have n equals 2, it's the same kind of story. But now if we start with spin 0, the first supersymmetry will give us a spin 1/2. The second supersymmetry will give us another spin 1/2. I can't do this first one again, but I can do the second one to this one and get a spin 1. And I can do the first one to this one and get a spin 1, but then I'm done. Because if I do this one twice, I get 0. I do that one twice, I get 0. And so you only get these four states. And you can kind of see that they come to you as two n equals 1 states. So this would be this would be what you'd call a gauge, an n equals 2 gauge multiplet. And it contains an n equals 1 chiral multiplet plus an n equals 1 gauge multiplet. And another thing you can do is we could have started with -1/2. We could have then gone to 0, gone to 0, and then gone to 1/2. This is n equals 2 matter multiplet. Multiplet, which is 2 n equals 1 chiral multiplets. But in particular, you see that supersymmetry is taking you from -1/2 to 1/2. And so any symmetry that commutes with supersymmetry is going to act in the same way on the plus half helicities as the minus half helicities. And normally the antiparticles transform under the complex conjugate representation. So that means that a multiplet, a matter multiplet in n equals 2 supersymmetry is always in a real representation. Of the gauge group. So you could never get the standard model. So you could never treat the left-handed and right-handed particles differently in a gauge symmetry. And so when people are trying to describe nature, they'd normally start with n equals 1. Because n equals 1, I can choose these chiral multiplets to be in a representations that treat the left and right handed fermions differently, whereas here I can't. And that's kind of one of the things that stops phenomenology of n equals higher than 1 supersymmetry. But I want to fill these out a little bit, because when we talk about quantum corrections, the nice things happen when you have a lot of supersymmetry. N equals 4 is the biggest n you can have, which only involves spin 1 or less. Because we could have n equals 1, we could start with -1. We'd have 4 supersymmetries to give us the -1/2. Then we act again with another one where there's 6 scalars we can get that way. And then we act with the other ones, we're going to have 4/2. And then we're left with 1, and then we're done. So it's the logic is that we had 4 independent supersymmetries we could apply. Here's the first one, here's the second one, here's the third one, here's the fourth one. and you get nothing more than that. So every time you have supersymmetry, you have for n supersymmetries, you'll have n a difference of n between the largest and smallest helicity multiplet. And you can kind of see that this groups itself into 1 n equals 2 gauge plus 1 n equals 2 matter. One way to see that is to, you can look at the n equals 1 multiplets. There's a here's a gauge multiplet, here's a gauge multiplet, here's a bunch of matter multiplets. Ran out of zeros. What happened there? 1, 2, 3. That's because I only drew 5 of them. There's supposed to be 6. Let me write that. You also see that it's automatic that you're going to have equal numbers of bosons and fermions. That's another way to see why a complex scalar had to go with the fermion, because the fermion had 2 spin states, but the scalars only had 1. So you needed 2 of them to get the same number of states as the fermions. So why do you care about the n equals 4? I don't want to touch that one, right? So I'll bring the top one down. So you remember we had this formula this morning about how things run, right? We had 1 over alpha was 1 over alpha naught minus b log of mu squared over mu naught squared. And b was 1 over 12 pi times the representation of this complex scalars plus twice the representation of the left-handed spin of half fields minus 11 times the adjoint representation of the gauge fields. Let's imagine that we lived in an n equals 1 supersymmetric world. So for n equals 1 supersymmetry, what we would have is we'd have each matter multiplet, each chiral multiplet. Let's say the chiral multiplet transforms in what I'll call R chiral. That's the representation of the gauge group it carries. The gauge multiplet will always be in the adjoint representation. But the chiral multiplet, remember, is that's one complex scalar in this multiplet, and one left-handed fermion in the same multiplet. And a gauge multiplet, let's say it's in the adjoint. Well, then we're going to have a gauge multiplet. You remember was a fermion and a gauge boson. So that means it's one left-handed fermion plus one gauge boson in the adjoint representation. So if I specialize these things to those choices, I only have adjoints and chiral representations to the gauge group, whatever it is, then what's going to happen is every chiral representation, I'm going to get one of these and one of these. So I'm going to get a factor of 3 in front of the t of the chiral representation. So b, you know, n equals 1, Suzy, is going to be 1 over 12 pi 3 times t of the chiral representation, 1 from the scalar and 2 from the fermions. And then the gauge fields are going to give me 1 from here and 1 and 11 from here. So I'm going to get 2 minus 11 is minus 9 for the adjoint representation. So the 3 comes out, and I can have 1 over 4 pi. This is a famous formula. Now let's say we were interested in n equals 2 gauge theory. So if I take the same thing for n equals 2 multiplets, so for n equals 2, every matter multiplet, so matter transforming in Rm, that means that 2 n equals 1 chiral multiplets are in this representation, and gauge in the adjoint means one matter plus one gauge, n equals one. So in that case, the for n equals two theories, you know, every time I'm going to have actually two of these. If I have one matter multiplied at n equals two with this transformation property, that means I've got two of these. So I'm going to get two times the Dinkin index for the matter multiplet. And then for the gauge multiplets, I'm going to get one of these and one of these. So I'm going to get one minus three is minus two. That's going to be one over two pi. The matter index minus the adjoint one. And then now you can kind of see that if I did n equals four, that means it's one n equals two matter plus one n equals two gauge in the adjoint, then beta for n equals four is going to be zero, always, just because they're canceling. So that's an example of how supersymmetry is making, the whole motivation was we wanted supersymmetry to help with making these low dimension operators go away. And the low dimension operators are sensitive to very high energy physics. And so, in the same way that the running is also seeing high energy physics, as you integrate out scales at high energies, you're seeing these things run. And if you have supersymmetry going on at high energies, this shows you that the running eventually goes away. You can't have scale invariance, or it's hard to get scale invariance in a theory with no or a few supersymmetries. But n equals four supersymmetry, supersymmetric Yang-Mills, will like to be scale invariant, and not just classically, but at the quantum level, because these quantum corrections that would be giving you scale dependence are canceling. And they're canceling because you get better UV properties, so fewer divergences. And it's because in loops, bosons and fermions come in with opposite signs. And they can cancel because the Fermion-Feynman rule gives you a minus sign when you put it in a loop. And another example of this is if you calculate the one loop vacuum energy of a bunch of particles in a supersymmetric theory, or in a non-supersymmetric theory. So another example is if we calculate the one loop vacuum energy, which would be the contribution to lambda, it turns out to be given by delta lambda. It's some number, and I forgot what it is, divided by 64 pi squared. It's one, or it's two, or it's some number like that, times the trace over the scalar mass matrix minus twice the trace over the spin a half mass matrix, and then plus three times the trace over the spin one mass matrix. This combination is sometimes called, it's this number over 64 pi squared. It's called the supertrace of the mass matrix, where the supertrace means sum over spins of minus to the twice the spin times 2s plus 1 times the trace of the corresponding mass squared matrix for that spin. And so the relevance of this is that if all the masses had been the same, you can kind of see that if you have equal numbers of bosons and fermions, you're going to get zero here, because the scalars will, each complex scalar will take out one fermion. And if you count them all up, if everybody had the same mass, then the bosons plus the fermion, the spin one bosons, are canceling the spin a half particles, because the I don't know if that's obvious to you or not. But again, the signs are coming in because of the fermions are entering the loops with the opposite sign. And so when you calculate this vacuum energy in supersymmetric theories and you don't break supersymmetry in supersymmetric theories, unless Susie is spontaneously broken. So if your vacuum isn't spontaneously so if your vacuum is not supersymmetric, then it will no longer be true that different particles in a supermultiple have the same mass, and then this cancellation will start to fail. But it'll fail by an amount given by the splitting in masses, so the size of the supersymmetry breaking will be the natural size of corrections to lambda, and and a similar story goes through for mu. So if you calculate, and I want to say this story for mu because it sets up the rules for making a Lagrangian. So if I want to look at the corrections to this term in the Lagrangian, what I would do is I'm looking for, I take the Higgs, and there'd typically be some fermion, let's say, like standard model fermions in the loop. That would be something which would contribute to this a large amount. And if these are heavy fermions, that would be proportional to the mass of that heavy fermion squared. But in a supersymmetric theory, what happens is that this fermion will have a partner. Let's call that partner curly F. And there's a graph like this, where this is curly F. And again, these have opposite signs because that's a fermion and that's a boson. And so if this coupling was called G, so that would be like the Yukawa coupling. Let's let me call Y for Yukawa. So if your Yukawa Lagrangian was Y times fermion bar fermion phi schematically, then these will cancel each other perfectly. So this will be equal to zero if the mass of the scalar is equal to the mass of the fermion, and the couplings have to be the same. So if I call that coupling lambda, we had to have an interaction which was lambda phi star phi f star f. And lambda had to be basically y squared. So both these things had to be true to make this thing cancel, whereas just the masses were involved here. And so the last thing I want to say is the rule for calculating these interactions in an n equals 1 supersymmetric theory is that the Yukawa couplings come to you. What you specify in supersymmetry, for reasons I'm going to give in a second, is you specify a function of the fields, but not their complex conjugates. It's called the superpotential. So in this case, I would give you a function of phi and f. And it turns out I'm going to need something cubic to give you, for reasons you'll see in a second. So the rule for computing Yukawa and potential terms, which I'm about to explain in 5 minutes, but I want to state it here so you kind of see why it's making this work, is that the Yukawa term is given by the second derivative of some function. I guess if we want this particular one, it would be with respect to f squared times phi. There'd also be things like a second derivative of the same function with respect to phi and with respect to f times curly f. That's the and these would be times the I'm trying to do this too quickly. So times f bar gamma left f, so these things I differentiated by, times phi. No, not times phi. This will be a function of phi. I'll have d2 w df d phi times f bar gamma left. And then phi will have a partner too, which I'll call psi, plus complex conjugate. Those will be the Yukawa couplings. So if I tell you some function w, which I haven't told you yet, then if I differentiate it twice, I read off what would be the coupling constants for the Yukawa couplings. And the scalar potential is given by the same function. It turns out to be given by v is given by sum over all the fields of the derivative of w with respect to the field. So let's in this case, let's say there's two fields, f and phi. So in particular, if w had been, let's say I said w was phi squared, then in these rules, what would happen is that the scalar potential would have the first derivative of w, so w d phi. Let's say it's going to turn out this is dimensions of mass cubed, so I have some parameter here with dimensions of mass. So dw d phi will be m phi. I'm going to drop factors of 2. So the potential I would get would be this thing squared, which would be m squared phi dagger phi. So you can kind of see that the m that's appearing here is going to be the mass of the scalar. But the Yukawa coupling I would have gotten from this would have been I'm supposed to take two derivatives with respect to phi, and I'm supposed to multiply by the fermion that goes with that, which is psi bar gamma left psi plus complex conjugate. But this is just m, if I take that. And so that's saying the fermion has the same mass as the scalar, which kind of makes sense if that had been a symmetry of the problem. But if W had been cubic, so if W had been phi f squared, then d2w df squared that I would have been putting in here would be something like, let's say it's got a coupling y here. It would be y times phi, whereas d2w d phi df would be y times, it would be 2y times f. And so what happens is that these Yukawa couplings, that this putting this into this gives me Yukawa coupling. It gives me fermion fermion times Higgs with a coupling which is y. So this coefficient y is what is turning out to be the Yukawa coupling. But in the scalar potential, what's happening is that v is, if I take dw df, I'm going to get y times phi f squared. And if I take dw d phi, I'm going to get y times f squared squared. And so this has a piece which is indeed y squared times phi dagger phi. Let me call it f dagger f to distinguish the scalar from the fermion. And then something involving f to the fourth. But the thing that we needed to have happen, that the quartic coupling in the potential was the square of the Yukawa coupling, is going to happen with the rules that I'm going to give you. So what happens is that in these things, you get cancellations that are exact if the fermions and the bosons have exactly the same mass and their couplings are the supersymmetric ones. And then the cancellation starts to fail if you break supersymmetry. And the story that people use in phenomenology is that they say that when we get to the standard model, you don't have partners of the standard model with the same quantum numbers that have opposites, the different spins. And so that the splitting has to be at least the experimental splitting of order of TeV. And because of that, these corrections can be at the TeVest kind of a scale. So let me bring it all home. So the thing that's missing is, I kind of told you a cartoon here. Why this is kind of a bizarre rule for making the Lagrangian. How do you make Lagrangians for n equals 1 supersymmetry that are supersymmetric? That's kind of the thing you would need to know if you wanted to try and write down the supersymmetric standard model.
How are you choosing your expressions for W again?
Sorry?
Why are you saying like W equals?
Oh, I haven't justified anything. I'm just saying that, so the rule for a supersymmetric Lagrangian is like normally for a regular Lagrangian, you feel yourself entitled to choose any potential you like. So what's going to happen in supersymmetry is that you will be entitled to choose a function W of the fields that you have in your problem, and you can choose whatever you like. But once you've chosen it, then the terms in the Lagrangian are all given by various derivatives of it and along this way. And so I'm saying that if you had a quadratic term in W, that's going to turn into a mass term for bosons and fermions. You have a cubic term that's going to turn into Yukawa couplings and quartic scalar interactions, but with related couplings. So what will happen is in the standard model, I'll have to tell you what W is for the standard model, but you'll recognize that it's going to be all the Yukawa couplings that we wanted to have. They'll all be there. But what's missing is, why do I choose, what's W and why do you get that bizarre rule, which is what I want to explain now. So W is called the superpotential. So this is n equals 1 supersymmetric. And I'm doing global supersymmetry. I'm kind of ignoring supergravity. In 4 dimensions. So the simplest way to do it is through superspace. And all superspaces, it's a very slick representation of supersymmetry on the fields. So the hard way to proceed is you say, I've got some fields, I give them some transformation laws, and I guess the transformation laws. But the hard thing will be, we're going to guess them, and sometimes the guess might involve parameters we might want to change in the Lagrangian. You like to have a rule for making the Lagrangian which doesn't depend on where the transformation rules don't depend on the Lagrangian itself. They're just defined in terms of some symmetry. And superspace gives you a way to do that for n equals 1 supersymmetry. So the idea is that the algebra of the supersymmetry transformations, it looks very much like a spacetime. They look like translations, except in a funny way, because you've got both translations in spacetime, in ordinary spacetime, and these supersymmetric transformations, which seem like they're square roots of translations. And so the observation is that you can represent supersymmetry on fields through the trick of, we're going to suppose that that there's more coordinates to space-time than the usual four. There's going to be extra coordinates, but they're fermionic coordinates rather than bosonic coordinates. I'm introducing fermionic space-time coordinates. So that means a field will be a function of x, the usual space-time coordinates, plus a bunch of things I'm going to call theta, which are spinners. And they're anti-committing spinners. But they're not functions of x, so it's not spinner fields. They're just spinner coordinates. And a complete label of where you are in superspace is to say, is to essentially tell you, specify your position as well as the values of these fermionic quantities. That sounds kind of bizarre because, you know, how do you specify the value of a fermionic quantity? The way, what makes it useful is because these are fermionic variables, they're square, they anti-commute with themselves, and so their square is zero, so that if you do a Taylor expansion in powers of theta, it stops. So in particular, if this thing has no Lorentz property, so it's like a scalar field, then the theta equals zero term in the expansion is a scalar, and the thing that's linear in theta, if this is a scalar, will have to be a fermion, a spinner. And I'm expanding in the left-handed piece because I'm hiding something that it's kind of in detail important, but not really important for what I want to say. And that's going to turn out to be, so that's a fermion. And then because a spinner, you know, a spinner is a Majorana spinner, a left-handed spinner, a Majorana spinner has a left-handed part and a right-handed part, which is left-handed part complex conjugate up to a matrix. And this thing has two components because it's a two-component spinner. And so that means that theta squared, each of the components squared is zero. But if I square theta as a spinner, if I write down theta bar theta, I can get something non-zero, which is the product of that component with the next component. So the thing stops at the theta left squared level. And there'll be something I'm going to call f of x. Now, dimensionally, if this is dimensions of mass, so will this. If this is dimensions of mass to the 3/2, this has to be mass to the minus 1/2. And then this has to be mass to the minus 1. This has to be mass squared. So this won't be a field. This won't be a usual field like we think of scalar fields. It's going to be what's called an auxiliary field. But the observation is that if I can make a rule where the things are invariant under x mu goes to x mu plus some translation, like I would have normally done for space-time, but I also supplement it with a rule where theta goes to theta plus epsilon, which is a supersymmetry transformation. And I have to tweak the rule a little bit to make sure that the algebra works. I don't want these things to commute with each other because I want two supersymmetry transformations to become a translation in space. So I'm going to not tell you what that is just because all you really need to know is that it can be done. And once you've done that, then what will happen is that if I take a superfield and I Taylor expand it like this, what will happen is that this thing transforms under translations the way you normally would have expected it to. You differentiate it and you multiply by, you know, how much you translate it by. And that induces a transformation rule for phi and psi, and it's exactly the ones we've been talking about. But instead of involving things like m, what will appear here is something like f. So this f here, I guess I should call it f. And what's going to happen is that when we solve f's equations of motion, it's going to turn into m times phi, so it'll give us back what we had up there. But f is something which is phrased in terms of f, this auxiliary field. The transformations don't make reference to any parameters in the Lagrangian. So that's the observation, is that by choosing fields in the superspace and choosing the transformation rules for the super coordinates in the right way, you can write the transformation rules for fields in a way which is kind of a very geometrical thing. And the analog of this for the gauge fields would be if I take a spinner field, let's call it f. This would be a gauge index. And it's got a spinner index that I'm not writing. Then the Taylor expansion for it will also stop at some point. So the first term will be the gaugino. And then the next term turns out to be a scalar piece plus the gauge field strength times gamma mu nu times theta. And then there's the third term here, it turns out to be d slash lambda times theta left bar theta left. And then it stops. And if you work out the transformation rules that lambda and f get, it's the ones that I was kind of alluding to before. And so once you have fields and you know how they transform, then you can make rules for how to make invariant actions. And it's very much like what we do when we're doing general covariance. You can make an action which is invariant by demanding that the Lagrangian, the action will be the integral over all space of something, and you ask the Lagrangian to transform in a specific way, like a scalar. So what we want, the invariance, turns out there's a similar statement in superspace. And again, they're obtained by doing integrals over functions, Lagrangian densities, which are built from the field. So there's two kinds of identities. One is called the D term for historical reasons, and it's the integral. So the Lagrangian is the integral over the fermionic coordinates. So there's an integral over the two left-handed fermionic coordinates and over the two right-handed fermionic coordinates. And then there's some Lagrangian, which you get to choose, which is built out of the fields on superspace. So let's say phi and phi star. Phi will depend on theta left, so phi star will depend on theta right. And then if you have both of them in there, you can do an integral over theta left and theta right. That's kind of why they're both there. And this K is called the Kähler potential. And it's not an accident that it's called the Kähler potential, because there's a Kähler geometry hidden in here. The other thing you can write, which is invariant, is called an F term. And that is that if you have a function that only depends on theta left and not theta right, so if you only had phis and not phi stars, you can just do the integral over theta left. So this is called this LD, this will be LF, E2 theta left of, now there's, if I just have phis, I can take any function of the phis, and this is what W is that I was talking about before. But I have to build it from phi and not phi star. But I also, if I have gauge fields, I can include these guys. So I could have something like F bar A gamma left F B times some coefficient FAB of phi, but not phi star. And I could have higher derivatives of these, and I'm just, don't take these as being the most general things, but there's a, for renormalizable interactions, these are the most general things. So this is called the superpotential. And this is called the gauge coupling function. And the important thing is these ones are holomorphic in the sense that they do not depend on phi star. And so now, the way you do integrals in superspace is easy because a function of theta is a polynomial. An integral over theta is basically the same thing as differentiating. So the integral, the rule is, if I wanted to write the integral d2 theta left of phi, it's f. If I integrate d theta left once, I would strip off one of the thetas. If I integrate twice, I strip off both thetas. And so another way of saying this, that these are invariants, is saying that if I take the last term in a superfield expansion, if I ask how does it transform under supersymmetry, it transforms into a total derivative. And that's why if I take this thing, which is, this is just essentially take the last guy in the expansion in powers of theta, if I integrate it over space, so if I write integral d4x of it, it will be invariant because the variation of this guy is always the derivative of something. It's always, so delta f is always epsilon bar, it's always d mu epsilon bar gamma mu times typically psi. So because it's a total derivative, it makes a good Lagrangian. So the rule is, you tell me k, you tell me w, you tell me little f, and then I turn the crank by doing these integrals, and I read off what the Lagrangian is. And in particular, so let me simplify my life a little bit. So to be renormalizable, K is at most quadratic. W is at most cubic. And FAB is constant.
So then it's kind of, you don't really have to think about it being there.
But what happens is that the expansion of this term, so then the, say the K term here, so the D term, it gives you all the kinetic terms for the matter fields. It gives you things like d mu phi dagger d mu phi. And it also gives you the fermions psi bar d slash psi. And it gives you things like F, complex conjugate F, where Fs are the things that are the last components of the phis. And this term here, the F bar F term, F, gives you things like the gauge kinetic terms. It gives you the Gaugino kinetic terms. It gives you things like D, where D is times FAB. D is the thing that appeared here. It's a scalar field. It's also an auxiliary field with dimensions of mass squared. And then the W term gives the things I told you. It gives you second derivative of W with respect to phi I, phi j, times the corresponding fermions. And it gives you dw d phi times f plus complex conjugate. And so if you now, d and f only appear undifferentiated and at most quadratically in the action, so the integral over them is a Gaussian integral. So you can just do that Gaussian integral once and for all, and the answer is the same thing as if you evaluate it using its saddle point, which is the classical equations of motion. And so that leads you to the final answer. So Gaussian integral, and this is an exact, because it's Gaussian, it's not really a classical approximation, equals a saddle point for F and D. And the saddle point is that F is equal to dW d phi I complex conjugate, and D is equal to scalar field dagger, it's equal to the inverse matrix FAB times scalar field dagger generator B scalar field. And that means I forgot to write something here. So in here, there's also a piece. There's a piece here which is DA times phi dagger phi. So there's a quadratic formula for D, which is the solution of that. Quadratic formula for F, because there's that and this. And that's the solution. You plug that back in, and you get the scalar potential that I gave you, and you get the you get actually more than I gave you. So the scalar potential becomes sum over fields of dw d phi squared plus something coming from the d's, which is sum over the gauge generators of phi dagger ta phi dagger tb phi. So this is called the F term potential, say V sub F. This is called the D term potential, V sub D. And the Yukawa couplings are the ones I told you already. Here, those are the Yukawa couplings. So let me just close with the thought of what the field content of the standard model is, and then we're done. If that's all right? Because there's I got one point I want to make, and that is, it's all very nice ultraviolet properties, but you give up something in the standard model when you do all this. And let me just tell you what that is and then leave it at that. So for the minimal supersymmetric standard model, just take all your standard model fields. So you have phi, quarks, leptons, gauge fields, that's it, right? Now the thing is that if supersymmetry commutes with the standard model gauge group, the superpartners will have to be new particles that are not already on this list, with the possible exception of L with phi. They could have been partners of each other because they have the same quantum numbers. But when you do that, actually turns out to be a dead end, in the sense that if L and phi were related to each other by supersymmetry, then you get interactions that would be a problem. So what people normally do in the MSSM is they just make a copy for everybody. So I'll call them tildes. So these are spin a half, because they're the partners of gauge bosons. These are the gaugeinos. That's the Beano, the Weino, and the Gluino. So this is the Higgs. So this is the also spin a half. So that's the Higgsino. The quarks, the partners are the squarks, so the scalar quarks. And these are the Seleptons, because they're the scalar leptons. And so this would be the Selectron, the sup quark and the down quark. But one thing so then we want to write down a superpotential that gives us Yukawa couplings, and we're trying to get, you remember, Yukawa couplings of the form in the standard model. We had L E phi Q D phi and Q U phi star. So we'd like to write down in the superpotential these three things, and this is going to be a problem because it's got phi star and not phi, and the superpotential can only depend on phi, not phi star. So because of that, you need another Higgs. So call that one phi 1. So W will be, basically Y, it's some coefficient, let's call it Y E L E phi 1 plus Y D Q D phi 1 plus Y up Q U phi 2. And that will give you the right Yukawa couplings. And these will really be matrices in generation space and all the things that you'd want to do. So that'll give you the Yukawa couplings you want. So this is the standard model superpotential. And the gauge couplings will be for free because we assign these things exactly the same transformation rules as these guys. And then you go to town. And then basically the rule is that if you have an interaction that you had in the standard model, so you had a fermion, a different fermion, and a gauge boson, then the supersymmetric rules are basically saying you take any two of these things and replace them by superpartners, and you also have that same interaction with the same coefficient. So let's call this H rather than F. If the coupling constant here is G, then if I make these guys superpartners now, we have the scalar, so F tilde H tilde A with strength G. If those guys are superpartners, we'll have a fermion scalar fermion, where this is now the gauge gaugeino. This will be H tilde. Let me call this, I guess, A tilde. This will be F. And if we make those guys superpartners, we'll have fermion, where this is F tilde, A tilde, and H. And they all have the same strength. So this interaction is the one that we're talking about here. Oh, it's buried in the covariant derivative here. So that's great. So what's the problem? One of the beautiful things of the standard model was you take all the renormalizable things and you write down the most general thing you can write down, and it's the standard model, and it has all these accidental symmetries that it gets right, like baryon number, lepton number, and so on. One thing you should always ask in this case is this the most general renormalizable thing you could write down? Are there other cubic things you could write down that are not this? And the answer is there are other things you can write down. So other things that are not there that are also cubic are possible in supersymmetry, and they're a problem because they violate baryon number. And then I'm basically done. So let me tell you what they are. So there's L phi 2. There's QLD I can write down. There's LLE or DDU. Those are all allowed by the gauge symmetries, and they're all perfectly allowed if the only rules are supersymmetry and gauge symmetries, but they satisfy that delta B is not zero and delta L is not zero at the renormalizable level. So this would mean protons would decay, in less than a second. So there's no suppression by any mass scales. So that's a big problem. And it's much uglier than it was in the standard model where it was all automatic. You can get rid of these things. There's a symmetry called R parity, which is basically minus to the Fermion number plus 3 times the baryon number minus lepton number. If those are all symmetries, then that has the property that all the standard model particles plus phi 2 are even, and all the superpartners are odd. And the reason that's useful is that, you know, if you ask on why was it possible to write down things that were normalizable and baryon number violating when we couldn't do it with the standard model, it's because you've got these all these new fields. All these guys allow you to do it. So you can write things down like if I take this thing, I can take d quark, up squark. I didn't have the up squark before, but now I can write these things down and they can have net baryon number that changes. But you can kind of see that they always have two ordinary particles and one odd one, so this kind of a symmetry will kill it. So this symmetry will remove, this is called R parity. Any symmetry that does not commute with supersymmetry is called R symmetry for historical reasons. And so that kills all these guys, but not from the dimension 5 thing. So in supersymmetry, it's always true that baryon number is closer to you than you thought it was going to be, because in a supersymmetric grand unified theory, it turns out the leading operators at low energy come in with 1 over 1 power of mass rather than 2 powers of mass, because they arise at this dimension 5 level rather than dimension 6, and that's kind of an ugly feature of supersymmetry. So the bottom line is, supersymmetry is like gauge theories were in the 50s, right? It's a really beautiful picture. It does nice things at high energies, but no one really knows quite how to fit it into nature. It looks like string theory requires it, so at very high energies, it's probably there when you talk about gravity. And it's to do with the nice features it has at high energies. But it doesn't, you know, it's very great hypothesis that you could understand why mu is less than the scale of the weak interactions, but only if the symmetry is there, and that means all these superpartners are also there at the weak scale, and so you should be able to see them at the LHC. And if they'd seen them, it would have been a huge triumph, but they didn't see them. So now you kind of don't really know what to do with the argument. But so whether or not supersymmetry is true at the weak scale is anybody's guess. But it's certainly looking bad in the sense that some of these things that were new are strongly interacting. So the squarks in particular and the gluinos, and those you should have seen. If they had been, they shouldn't have been so hard to see. And so those are the bounds that are getting uncomfortable. And as the next few years, the bounds on the weakly interacting particles are also going to start to get uncomfortable unless they see something. But that's where we are. So, thank you for hanging in to the end. I'm sorry I ran over late there.